mind the discussion which is what we're about. So welcome and carry on.
Thanks very much. May I start by first of all thanking Peter and Ted for taking me out to lunch, dinner, and it's the most enjoyable meal it was as well. And thank you as well for coming. And I hope that what I'm going to talk about this evening will be of interest. It combines a certain amount of statistical work with quite a practical kind of question, which I will say more, as I said, it relates to this business of cold calling, which is becoming an increasing problem. It has been for a long time, but it's becoming more so. So I hope that in the course of this discussion, I will give you a little bit of insight into what the police are trying to do in addressing the problem of cold calling, and show you some of the contributions that statistics can make to assessing whether or not the initiatives they've taken have had any kind of success. So, without further ado, what I want to do, because I was assured that you don't just want me to talk about the statistics, indeed, in some ways I'm not the best person to do that, because the work I'm going to talk about was a collaboration, as will become clear shortly, with a group of very impressive statisticians at Imperial College, London. And if you were to have some really difficult statistical questions, I may have to say, well, I will get back to you on that one. because although I have made it my business to in the modern jargon, get my head around the statistics, in some senses, I suppose you could say it's the crime aspect that appeals to me most of all. But I've always been fascinated as a geographer in the different ways in which statistical theory, statistical methods can shed insight into the questions that we look at. Now, the structure of what I'm going to say is I'm going to first of all provide a very broad context to this No Cold Calling initiative, which I'm going to talk about, very broad context indeed. Then I'm going to actually report the results of the research that we did, and then I'm going to come back and try to pull together one or two of the themes. I don't know if it's your practice in these meetings to, if you have a question, to ask them while I'm talking. That's absolutely fine, if that's the way you do things. If you want to wait until the end, that's fine as well. So let me start then with the context. And what I'm trying to do here is to place No Cold Calling initiatives in a wider context. And if we were to do that, if we sought to do that, I suppose we might go back to the 1998 Crime and Disorder Act, which in some ways, I suppose, set a framework within which policing in this country was to be carried out, a broad policy framework. As it says there, greater use of intelligence-led, proactive, rather than simply reactive policing, rather than reacting to crime, trying to actually, in a proactive sense, prevent crime, reduce crime, involve interagency work. I suppose the sort of jargon phrase for that is joined up thinking. You may well have come across this in other contexts where different government departments are made or encouraged to think about the what you might call the unintended consequences or the externalities of their policy. So for example, the consequences of the construction and design of a new housing estate in respect of crime, or some aspect of the justice system and its impact on health, perhaps. So this notion of joined up thinking, or put there in a slightly different way, the idea of different parts of government talking to one another and thinking through the wider consequences of their action. So moving from a proactive framework to an increasingly preventative mode of working. Secondly, to recognize the importance not just of, if you like, the rate of different crimes, the levels of different crimes, but also people's fear of crime and the need to provide reassurance. Reassurance policing has become, again, a bit of a buzzword, not just in this country, but elsewhere, particularly in the United States. The idea of, but it's not just about keeping criminals off the streets, reducing crime. It's also about trying to address the needs of people in terms of what their fears are and trying to reduce the level of fear and anxiety that exists within the society.
May I perhaps ask a question at this point? Because this notion of importance of fear of crime can cut in several directions. One is that the fear itself may be excessive, given the circumstances. Another is that fear, if it can be observed or measured, is an index of the neighbourhood's awareness of the risk of crime. So it is, in fact, informative. So is that going to come out both ways?
I think that the position of those who talk about reassurance policing is that their view is that people's fear of crime exceeds the real risk of becoming a victim of crime that they face.
But do you then have a problem of translating fear into risk?
The two may be totally disjoint in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, fear might possibly be measured, for instance, by the number of times somebody goes into the police station to report worry about crime.
Oh, I don't think I think the way in which people's fear of crime is measured is through things like the British Crime Survey, in which they talk to people, they take samples, and they ask people about their anxiety levels, and those anxiety levels are measured year on year. Obviously, it's a different sample, but within the limits of sampling theory, they would observe that people's anxieties about becoming a victim of crime.
So, on that basis, it is unlikely to be neighbourhood specific.
Well, in the case of the British Crime Survey, of course, it isn't neighbourhood, because they take a sample across the country. They have, in certain years, carried out neighbourhood-based surveys. They've tried to focus, so there is a geography to the results that they get out, but for the most part, the British Crime Survey takes a survey of national trends. Okay, well, maybe we'll come back to that. The second theme that I just want to use as a context, the importance of the neighbourhood for delivering crime prevention and as well as tackling the fear of crime. There, of course, is a tradition of neighbourhood policing. You just have to think about beats and the policeman on the beat, the reassuring figure of the policeman on the beat. Taking care of the people who live in that neighbourhood. But the neighbourhood, of course, because the police are an essentially territorial body, there are police force areas, and then within them there are basic command units, and within them there are beats, all of which are geographically defined. The neighbourhood is a natural framework for the police to think about the delivery of their services. But we think of the neighbourhood here in terms of this notion of preventative measures taken by the police rather than reactive, catching the criminal, if you like, at the neighbourhood level. It's about setting up schemes which might help to address or reduce the risk of an offence taking place in the neighbourhood. Now, these strategies, as we might call them, can take a number of different forms. they might be quite explicitly targeted. So certain neighbourhoods may be recipients of certain preventative schemes. No cold calling zones would be an example, just as crime hotspots would be examples. Some places get police resources and some don't. Okay, sort of a binary, you get it or you don't, depending on the circumstances in that neighbourhood. And that would be an example of a targeted. Some places are designed as no-call calling zones, some aren't. And then there are tailored strategies where the policy is applied, if you like, universally, but it's tailored, it's adjusted to meet the specific needs of the particular neighbourhood. So when we talk about neighbourhood policing, we include within it both targeted approaches to preventative policing and tailored strategies. Now, in a way, no call calling in Cambridgeshire falls very firmly in that group. Okay, there's one more thing I want to throw into the mix here, which provides, I think, an important context, and this is where the statistics comes in, and that is the growing availability of geocoded offender and victim data, the police's recorded crime data, which with suitable safeguards and signing up to police protocols, researchers can be granted access to their records. And that's what lies behind this research I'm talking about now, but which of course is a feature of a lot of this kind of work, because by being granted access to this data, this recorded crime database that the police assemble, we have an opportunity to explore the importance of place and space, the importance of place in terms of the occurrence of crime, and what geographers like to call spatial relationships, the juxtaposition of different places together, you know, certain neighbourhoods being close to the city centre, for example. So it's the spatial relationships between places as well as the characteristics of the places themselves, how that feeds in to different facets of crime and criminality. And then that can in turn feed through into different things that the police may find of use or not. Drawing maps of crime, probably less useful modelling crime, trying to get behind the maps to say a bit more about why we observe the patterns that we do. Crime hotspot detection. And last but not least, policy assessment. And that's really the leading
to... Sorry, Bob, you talked about geocoding the offence, the offender and the victim data. So is that saying you geocode both where the offence, all three, where the offence occurs, where the offender lives, and where the...
That's right.
All three things are recorded, aren't they?
All three things, to the extent that a crime has a location, of course, and that it can be recalled exactly where it took place, yes, they will give an address.
To the extent that you know who the offender was,
obviously you don't always know, and of course lots of crime goes unrecorded.
Yes.
I mean, we may want to have a little discussion about the quality of this kind of data, you know, how good it can be, given that lots of crime does not get recorded. Often the offender is not caught, and of course if the offence is not recorded, then the victim may not even want to be known that they've become a victim of crime, and so yes, this is going to be an issue in all this kind of work. I should add, and this is an important point, the police will never grant a researcher access to the literal geocoding, the address where the burglary took place, the exact location where rape occurred, for example. What they will give you is the output area where it occurred, which are quite small geographical zones, but they're not the exact points. They will not give you that. At least they won't now. There was a time, but they won't now. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the project itself. And it was a policy assessment. It was an assessment of the no cold calling zones that had been set up in Cambridgeshire. And this is just a bit of that research that I have been working with the three people who are named here, I think Sylvia Richardson is now in Cambridge, but at the time this work was done, she was at Imperial College. Nikki Best and Sylvia Richardson, I think, are very famous within your field. I've known Sylvia for a long time, going way, way back. She's very famous. And Bong Kwan Lee was the postdoc RA who did a lot of the hard work on this project. So let me talk a little bit. For those, I'm sure lots of you know about cold calling, but let me just try to clear the ground in a sense. Cold calling is defined very broadly as a visit or a phone call to a consumer by a trader, whether or not the trader supplies goods or services, which takes place without the consumer expressly requesting the contact. Actually, that's a slightly narrow definition of cold calling, because we should put the word trader in inverted commas. Sometimes they're just gangs. Sometimes they're just gangs who are pretending to be providers of services. They're not traders at all. But that's what a cold call is. It's somebody coming, phoning you up, but more importantly in the context of this piece of work and what the police are trying to do, it's somebody who comes to your door, knocks on your door and tries to sell you something. Now, that activity in and of itself is not illegal. And in fact, for many companies, it is a legitimate part of their business plan. Not surprisingly, this field is, if you had a different speaker this evening, they would talk about the societal consequences of this kind of policy, the ethical issues that are raised by trying to put off cold calling, because it does actually raise wider questions that I'm competent to talk about, but again, that might be something we want to pick up in wider discussion. But this whole issue of what's referred to as rogue trading, that has a slightly different connotation now. We think of leasing, don't we, as the rogue trade. You know, people in the stock exchange who play with our money and make huge sums for themselves and break the bank. Sometimes it's referred to as bogus selling. But the phrase rogue trading is also used. And the particular concern, of course, with this kind of doorstep bogus selling is that it becomes a kind of smokescreen for burglary. That in all sorts of ways, the person who's turning up on your doorstep is either just trying to suss the place out with a view to coming back later, or actually trying to gain entrance so that they can steal something and then be up. The reaction, the response of the police has been in Cambridgeshire to create no cold calling zone. Setting up an NCC zone, and this is where I just want to bring you back to the context I provided. Ted, I can see you have questions.
No, I'm just scanning down your...
All right.
Don't worry yet.
All right, I won't.
The cold call here is no doorstep.
Yeah.
It's not no telephone.
No, it's the cold. It's the doorstep call. Yeah, that's what they're trying to stop.
You can't prevent phone calls.
Well, you can presumably get some kind of filter put on your phone, the BT, but it doesn't work for us. We have been absolutely pestered with cold calls in respect to PPI. I'm sure you all have.
All sorts of things.
Yeah, well, PPI seems to be the worst thing right now. Okay, what I want to suggest to you is that the creation of these no-cold calling zones combines two things which are embedded deeply in criminology and policing. But first of all, it's partly about reassurance policing. It's reducing the fear of crime by prioritising a crime and disorder threat that concerns neighbourhoods. That will become clearer when I explain to you a little bit about why the neighbourhoods that were chosen by Cambridgeshire Police were chosen. But the point is that it's that no cold calling zones is not just about reducing crime, it's reducing people's anxieties about cold calling and how to deal with cold calling, which may or may not have criminal intent. So that's one thread that runs through the creation of these no cold calling zones. The second thread that runs through, which again well, if the first of those, the reassurance policing, engages with a, if you like, a theory of policing and what policing is all about, neighbourhoods, reassurance, prioritising a particular crime and disorder threat, this aspect of no-call calling you can think of as embedded within criminology and what's called situational crime prevention. And what that is all about is reducing crime by changing the environment. By changing the environment so as, first of all, to reduce the opportunity to offend, and secondly, increase the risk of getting caught if the motivator chooses to offend. Now, all I will say here is that this approach to policing, situational crime prevention, has its academic roots in two areas: rational choice theory and routine activity theory, which, to express in the simplest of all possible terms, the first of those, rational choice theory, says crime is not a pathological act. It is a rational response on the part of the individual to the world in which they find themselves in. Okay. Crime makes sense to them. If you go far enough back, crime was thought to be something that only somebody who was pathological would engage in. That notion shifted with this idea that actually it's a rational choice made by somebody confronted with the world as they find it. And the second part, routine activity theory, is, and the crime that they engage in is, if you like, part and parcel of their daily lives and the lives of their victims. So it's not an exceptional act. It's a rational act, and it's not an exceptional act on the part of the offender. And therefore, by changing the environment in which they might commit their crime, you can actually reduce crime. That's where the link comes with crime reduction. So I'm trying to set a little context for this work. And the situational crime prevention comes through if we just look at some of the ingredients of what no-call calling zones involve. They involve advice to residents on how to deal with cold callers through meetings and advice packs and the kind of stuff that you might expect to be given. Police presence through street and household signage. I'm sure you're all aware of neighbourhood watch signs that go up. Well, no-call calling zones, they're not as common as neighbourhood watches, but if you find a street in Cambridgeshire which is a no-call calling zone, it'll have signage which will say, make quite clear, cold callers are not welcome here, please do not go in. And the houses themselves will have the stickers on as well. Trading standards are involved because they set up schemes to try to sift the legitimate cold callers, because as I say, for some companies it's a legitimate part of their business model, to sift between those cold callers who are legitimate and those who aren't by giving passwords. I'm sure you've all had people come to your houses to do work, and the company, if they're a legitimate company, will say, and this person will have a password of your choosing. Tell me what you want that person to say in terms of password. So, you know, it's that kind of thing which is engaged there.
On that point, what you just said is fair enough where there is a definite and fair arrangement between, say, the householder and the trader. And they both, as it were, know about each other, and they set up this arrangement. The majority of crime-related cold calling will, in effect, be unpredictable.
Yep.
So there's, to my perhaps my view, there's almost no question of a cold caller being able to present a password. Because
they won't have a password.
There will be no arrangement.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. But all trading standards that they're trying to do, as I understand it, is they're trying to assist those companies for whom some form of calling, cold calling. I'll give you an example.
Let's say that the company has been approved as a legitimate cold caller, according to your trading standards for a legitimate cold caller.
Yeah.
Then
they call at a household that's not expecting them, how then can the householder check?
Well, they can't. If they went to a no-call calling zone, if the residents have been suitably advised, briefed, supported, they would tell them to go away. Normally what happens is that kind of cold calling is preceded by a phone cold call in which, and I was going to cite you the example that's happened to us recently. We've had our loft insulation put in and we were cold called by a company who had bought a list from providers of this and said, we believe that you are interested in having loft insulation, you know, the government scheme to put loft in. And we said, yes. Right, well, somebody will come to see you. What password do you want them to give you? Because they've obviously got to come in your house and they've got to go up in your loft and so forth. Yes. So it's that kind of process that they try to set
up. So you get a cold call asking you for a password.
Yes. Well, it worked for us anyway.
You hit the nail on the head because I had two precise cold calls on exactly that subject this morning.
Right.
You know, roof insulation.
Yes. Perhaps you should be worried.
No, not at all. I said, can we close this port now, please?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I haven't quite got the details of that. Right. I mean, I see where you're coming from. But there were a series of calls that preceded that, which, in a sense, left me a degree of confidence. Moving on. There's talking about hardening.
Just ask one quick question.
Yeah.
Are these zones law might be the wrong word for it, but are they enforced by the police or is it just the residents saying we are going to try and get this policy in this area?
When you say enforce, if anybody does cold call in that neighbourhood, they haven't committed a crime. That's what you mean. No. Okay, the other ingredient which defines this as a situational crime prevention. The police don't provide you with the resources, but they might advise you on how to fit better locks, which would go down as an example of target hardening. We just make it more difficult for the person to get in. So if somebody comes calling at your door, you put a key latch chain on, and you open the door, and then they can't just push their way in, which is another way in which cold calling can lead to break in. So that would. I mean, the police don't give you the cash to buy chains, but they would advise you where that might be best. And then higher levels of surveillance and information sharing. The other idea here, which again fits in with this notion of situational crime prevention, is that neighbourhood watch is not the best example of this, but the idea is as you kind of community spirit grows up and that people look out for one another. And they spread the word, oh, there's a cold caller coming down the street, he's tried my door, she's tried my door, I just want you to know about it. So this idea of social cohesion or social capital, which is very much in vogue these days, the idea of fostering that around preventative action. Okay, now this is all well and good to some extent, okay? But the question is, have these zones actually had a positive impact? You can appreciate that from the police's point of view, these kinds of schemes could be viewed in a variety of different lights. Maybe if the people in a no-call calling zone just feel better about life, or they in some sense feel that they are now safer than they were before, they might be deemed to be success, and there is certainly evidence to that effect. But the police are also about reducing crime, not just about making us feel good, but about reducing crime. So there is a question here about whether there is any evidence at all that these schemes have actually had a positive impact on burglary rates. That's where this little bit of research has come in. Those are the no cold calling zones in Peterborough, because we're just going to look at one small part of it. Well, Peter isn't in Cambridgeshire, but it falls within the zone of the Cambridge Constabulary. Those are the no-call calling zones that were set up in Peterborough in 2005 and 2006. If I just say,
as a...
did they last only 1 year, or did they persist?
Pardon?
Did they last only 1 year, or did they persist?
No, once they're in place, they last.
Right, okay.
Once they're in place, they last. And the police provide ongoing support. Not quite sure how often they meet with the residents, but they have a cycle of meeting with them to talk through issues. The reason why Cambridgeshire is fascinating is because no call calling as a police priority has been in place, is in place around the whole country. Most, I think all police forces seek to address cold calling. But Cambridgeshire have deliberately adopted a neighbourhood approach, as opposed to certain police forces. The Surrey Police Force is an example of this, where if you just phone up the police force, they'll send you a pack and you can put a sticker in your window which just says no cold calls here, please, you're not well welcome. This is targeted at neighbourhoods. Okay. So in that sense, Cambridgeshire is somewhat different from the kinds of schemes that are set up elsewhere. What are the selection criteria? Normally there are up to about 50 properties that are close together and generally occupied by older and vulnerable residents. And there are also neighbourhoods where there have been a comparatively large number of incidents of either doorstep calling or particularly distraction burglary. And the choice of those 10 or 11 zones, which I've just put up, were made by the police and trading standards with the involvement of neighbourhood watch coordinators. So it's a kind of tripartite group that determines which places will be chosen and which won't.
And the number of square meters that occupy each area is approximately the same?
No, they vary, as you'll now see. So though these are all the schemes that we're looking at in this little example of work from this project. So those are so down here are the names of the streets. This is the postcodes. These are the outward area codes. These are the number of dwellings that were part of the no cold call zone. So you can see they're varying. There's just 8 in that one, 10 in that one, 100 in that one, which is a home park. So they do vary quite a bit in size. They all started at slightly different times. Broadly, that group began in 2005, this group in 2006. There have been more since then, incidentally. There have been some set up in 2007 and some set up in 2008. But we don't have enough data. You've got to have a bit of a before and after if you're going to do any kind of assessment. And this actually then goes, in a way, this talk is about the problems of how you make an assessment of a scheme of this kind, because these are the number of dwellings in the outward areas within which these no-call calling zones sit. But that's the scale at which the data we have access to. So we can't get data on the individual households, as you've seen in due course. So at some stage, we're going to come back to this question of the incompatibility, if you like, between the zones that are the no-call calling zones and the geographical units in terms of which the police recorded crime data is given to us. Because as I said at the beginning, they'll give us the data at the output area level. They'll tell us the number of crimes committed, burglaries for example, committed at the output area level. They won't tell us about the number of burglaries for subsets. Corresponding
to those no-call calling zones. Something. Let's take the case of number 5, Boxgrove, Percy and I.
Yeah.
You have 8. Is that 8 dwellings taking part in the scheme?
Yes.
The 126
is the number of dwellings in that zone.
So we don't know actually whether the 8 is all of the houses in that close or whether it's just some of them, and we don't know how many streets around that close are involved in that area.
They'll all be in Boxgrove Close. But not all of Box Grove, I suspect all of Box Grove Close is in the scheme.
Yes.
But all the houses outside of Box Grove Close and in this outward area make up 118.
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah.
Okay. So there's a real difficulty there, of course. Mm-hmm. Okay. Others, it's not so bad. I mean, 60% of this output area is in a no-call calling zone. So this is an issue which we must return to.
Yeah. But the reason for asking that question, and probably you'll come to it, is that it could be that Box Grove Close is a small little back street backing onto Open Meadow or something, for all I know, and therefore has a special relationship with the surroundings, whereas the other properties in that OA area may be, so to speak, better protected. So when you're coming to do the comparative statistics, presumably the objective is to compare what happened to those 8 in the scheme, say with others in that OA area.
Which we can't do, because we're not given that data. The police won't give us that data. All they will tell us is the number of burglaries at this scale.
Right, so they won't tell you whether it's in Boxwell.
No.
Box Grove Close.
No.
Well, that's a lot of use, isn't it?
Well, hold on. Okay.
Yeah.
Pardon?
The column of numbers, do they correspond to households that are very close together?
Yes, they are all, for the most part, very close together. They're either on the same street or adjacent streets. They form a clearly defined neighbourhood in a very general sense.
But some of the dwellings on the other column can be also very close to the roads.
Well, if you look at the geography of an outward area, it tends to be reasonably compact. I mean, these have... maybe I should just make the comment that these zones were constructed in were first used in the 2001 census. They were very different from the old enumeration districts in terms of which census data was reported, because all of these were defined to be reasonably homogeneous in terms of housing tenure and certain aspects of socioeconomic characteristics, whereas the old enumeration districts, in terms of which data was reported in the census, were whatever was convenient for the enumeration of the census enumerators. It tended to reflect their walking patterns as they went to collect the forms or get the forms filled in. So geography is messy, but to the extent that you can make it less messy, then these zones have been set up in a way that they are reasonably homogeneous and they are reasonably small.
Could we quickly flip back to the paper of that?
I don't know what time you want me to finish tonight.
Well, this is what we do. Do those numbers correspond to the numbers on that list?
Yes. Yes, they do.
Right.
Yes, they do.
So number 4 is a huge area.
Yes.
Yes.
And that is therefore Mellows Close East.
Almost certainly that map is individual outward areas. These are just showing you the locations of where they are.
Right.
So that's an outward.
So that outward area with 120 or 30 dwellings in it is actually rather sparsely populated.
Yes, it's probably it must be. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, large parts of it could be parkland, for example. I mean, it could be, you know, if you were to look at the actual locations of the houses, they could all be concentrated up here. I mean, I don't know. Okay.
Right.
Let's have a look a bit at the statistics. That is the data through time. So we have data going back to 2001, we have data going up to 2008. This is the annual dwelling risk per 100 dwellings. Okay, this is the actual data. Burglaries per 100 dwellings, 4, 6, 8, and so forth. And each of these individual graphs are the individual NCC zones. Okay. The green is the average across all of the NCC zones through time. Okay, that green one is for the NCC zone, and the red is for all the rest of Peterborough, which was not in an NCC zone. Okay. At the output area level, at the OA level, And so you might say that that's the first suggestion we have, that there might have been some positive impact. Because remember, all of these schemes came in around 2005 and 2006. There is some sign of divergence. It's nothing more than a crude graph picturing the average across these two classes of zones.
Because the black line is below the average.
These are the individual OAs that constituted no cold calling zones. Okay. And then this is the average across those the black graphs. Green is for all the rest, which are the OAs that are not part of no cold calling zones. The rest of Peterborough, if you like.
So basically, you're succeeding if the green is definitely below the red.
If in some sense it's significantly below the red. But well, in a way, you see, you're hoping that if there is a divergence, it's going to be apparent after the time they've brought in the no cold calling zones. I mean, it wouldn't be very good if the green was above the red and was even more above the red after 2005, 2006. At least it's coming in the right direction.
Yeah.
Okay. That's about all one can say.
You're talking here, annual dwelling burglary per 100 dwellings is of the order of 232. Yeah. On that list of areas, you had something like 1,500 dwellings altogether. Yeah, so you've got 11 times approximately 130. You're of the order of 15,000.
1,500.
1,500, sorry. So, per 100 dwellings, you're talking out of 15,000, 1,500, at of the order of 2 per 100, you're talking of the order of 13.
Burglaries
per annum over the whole set.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's not big numbers.
No. Again, I mean, what in a sense, what one's highlighting there is actually the difficulty of making any kind of assessment of these things. But we plough on. Okay, so what did we decide to do? Okay, what's the strategy for trying to make some kind of assessment of the success or otherwise of the scheme? Well, obviously, part of it is to compare burglary rates before and after the implementation of the NCC scheme, because the difference between the two time periods is indicative of the influence of the pot policy. And that's sort of what I was implying there. Before and after. The other thing you have to do, if you're going to make an assessment, is make a comparison after adjusting for any systematic changes that may be happening in the burglary rates in other non-NCC zones. That is, the use of controls to try to help to differentiate how much of the change may be due to the policy impact, how much of the change may be due to other external factors. Now, before I deal with the last of those, let me just jump forward to tell you what the controls were. We had six controls against which to compare the NCC zones. All the NSOAs in Peterborough, that is, the whole of Peterborough, obviously excluding the no coal calling zones, all right? Okay, obviously excluding those. So you just take them all, and you use that as a control. The next three are all taking different subsets of this, dependent on their burglary rates at the time the NCC zone was brought in. Okay. All those LSOAs that had a burglary rate within 10% of the NCC group in 2005, all those within 20% in 2005, all of those were in 30% in both 2004 and 2005. So, three of our controls are in terms of how similar were their burglary rates at the time that the NCC zone was brought in.
That would be mutually exclusive, are they? One contained with the other. So it's 3 ± 20 but more than 10.
Yeah, some of these will be each of those, yes. Yeah.
One question about detail. When a burglary is recorded for the purpose of this NCC exercise, is it also noted whether or not that burglary can be associated with a preceding cold call?
No.
So?
No idea.
No idea at all?
No. They do have a separate category of what they call distraction burglary.
Yes, of course, but that's readily identified.
Yes, but it's not commonly used.
Yes, but they didn't actually ask the question when a burglary, when they turn up to a reported burglary, they don't ask, did anybody cold call you in the last week or two?
No. This is taken straight from the police's recorded crime database. So nothing about the wider context.
You have no idea.
No idea at all.
Burglary is associated with
building. No idea at all.
So you can only work with totals.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. The next is what we would call geographical proximity. That is, the LSOAs that contain NCC targeting OAs, but obviously excluding the NCC targeted bit of the LSOA. We call that geographical proximity. It's like the rest of the LSOA that's outside of a COA. So it's the places that are closest by. Okay, that makes sense. And the last control that we had, LSOAs that had similar multiple deprivation scores. So we had six control groups that we were going to do our comparisons on. Now the last thing I want to talk about in this strategy is the point that we have commented before, the sparsity of the data, the small number of burglary events. And this has been tackled two ways. One is by simply lumping all the NCC zones together, just treating them as one large lump, okay, not differentiating between them, and comparing them as a group, NCC targeted, with the non-NCC targeted. Okay, so that's one way of trying to finesse, if you like, the fact that we're talking about small numbers. However, we would also like to be able to say something about the individual NCC zones themselves, each of those 10 or 11, if we could. And this is where it was suggested that hierarchical, multi-level modeling of local impacts might do the trick, because this involves borrowing information in time and space in order to strengthen whatever estimation or inference you're trying to do. So that is the reason why in a few minutes you will see the kinds of models that Sylvia and Nikki and Guangguang came up with. Okay, in very simple terms, these graphs are intended to just give you an idea of how this works. And I'll show you the equations, which may or may not be of interest, but just show you in broad terms. So what we do is we take the data from a control group. So each of these control groups are going to be dealt with separately. And we're going to have six separate comparisons. And we get the control trend pattern through time. And then we get the data from the NCC group, which you can think of as being plotted against that control trend pattern. And then we construct the trend pattern for the NCC group through an impact function, where we can define the nature of the departure pattern, if it exists, whether it's a step function, a linear function, or something more complicated like that. And this coefficient here, this parameter in the model, will identify the magnitude of the departure, whether or not there's, and we can do the inference around the estimate we arrive at for that being.
One question here.
Yep.
You have a red curve which starts at, if I really write it up, 4. Okay, so in fact the black line and the red line are superimposed prior to the dashed line.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's an indicator function as part of this expression,
okay,
which will say, don't switch on until you reach the time,
yes,
when the NCC zone,
right,
so is created.
By definition, therefore, the red line is made to coincide with the black line, which is the control, the overall control trend pattern,
yes,
prior to the...
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
And this is despite the fact that you have three black dots which lie above that control trend pattern.
Well, this is just a schematic,
sure,
depiction of what's going on, but yes, that's possible. Yes, I guess that can happen.
Yeah, so, I mean, if I were to look at that graph, without, for the time being, thinking about the red curve, that would appear to me to be a reducing trend in the difference between the NCC group and the control group, starting at 2000, where the NCC group is above the control group, roughly equal at 2004-2005, and then below subsequent. And the fact that it is above preceding the introduction of NCC could not be due to NCC.
Certainly not. As I say, this is a somewhat a schematic depiction of the idea behind drawing this was simply to give a sense of what's going on.
How
you shouldn't take too literally.
The sense in which that might happen as well, though, because you chose the NCC because they were high.
Yeah, regressive to me.
Yeah.
Okay. And now we've had this question about the regression to the mean before, and there are a variety of answers to that. One of them, I can get them right. one of them is that, if I can remember this correctly, the fact that this, I'm probably going to get this wrong. We've been asked this question before, and those who know more about these things than I do are quite convinced that this is not that an example of that kind of thing. One of the reasons has to do with the fact that three of the control groups are based on matching the burglary rate, and that if there was regression to the mean, then when we test against those control groups, then you would expect there to be no significant difference.
So NCC group is matched with a control group?
Each NCC group is matched against different control groups. So there are going to be six sets of results for these six different types of control groups. There's a second reason why this is not a regression to the mean, but I can't remember the answer.
It's a good question, because I was asked this before.
Please go ahead.
Okay, two models, which is what lies behind the results I'm going to show. I'm going to show you, because I'm going to give you some results in a minute. And then you can think about those as well. So this is the model for the control group on the left-hand side here. So Y subscript IT is the number of burglaries in the ith member of a control group, whatever that happens to be, because there are going to be six different control groups, because this model is going to be fitted six times. So the ith member of the particular control group, whichever one that is, at time t. And that, because these are rare events, then this is assumed to be Poisson random. With these right t denoting the risk of burglary in the ith member at time t. Okay. These are the components of the random effects. There's a time effect, there's a place effect, and then because there is over dispersion in the data, there is a random effect coupled with the over dispersion. So that's the model for the control group. This is the model for the NCC data. Now in this, remember, we just lumped all of the no-call calling zones into one. We're not differentiating them, we're just taking them as a large group. So we just have data now through time. Same model, except that now we have this impact function. This is the indicator function, so that this effect can't kick in until after T0, which is the time the NCC zone was brought in. And then we can have different forms for this impact function. All the results that I'm going to show you are for the case of a linear impact function. That is, things got better and better after the no-call Collins zone was brought in. But it could have been a step. We've also tried a step function where you bring it in and there's immediate change and then it just levels off at that new level.
In these models, are you forcing the gamma t for control to be identical to the gamma t for NCC?
Yes.
Right.
Essentially, the way that Sylvia, Nikki, and Juan Quan put it is all the uncertainty that is bound up with the definition of the control group trend is carried over into this model. So we're actually carrying the uncertainty that we have about this control group trend into the estimation of the change through time in the NCC group. You'll also notice that some of these terms are the same as well, so they're carried over. This is fitted in a package called WinBugs, which I suspect lots of people know about, far more than I know about, and there's something called a cut function which allows you to do this. Don't ask me. That's
the no-code
coding
data. When do you decide which control group
we're doing all the control groups.
And the one that is
there's lots of uncertainty about who are the natural comparators for these different no-call calling zones. I mean, to put it in a sort of inferential context, this is certainly not an experimental model. I mean, we've got no control. It would be unethical to say, well, these are all terrible cold calling zones, we're going to choose you, and the rest of you are just going to have to sit there and wait until the results come out, and we'll let you know whether or not it's been successful or not. Ethically, the police have got to respond to all of them. So immediately we've lost any kind of randomization. So the approach that's been adopted is, well, let's try to set up lots of different control patterns, which provide a reasonable benchmark against which to compare the no-cold calling zone. It's what I think is referred to as a quasi-experimental design, or a natural experimental, which geography and the earth sciences, the environmental sciences, are full of all the time. We don't have control of the world we live in. We've got to take it as we find it.
In the left on the control group, for the log theta IT, you've got this index I. Is that for control group I?
No, that's for the ith member of the control group. Because remember,
that's what I mean. So you've got your six members.
Yeah, and then with each of them, you've got...
So I is 1 to 6. That's what I meant, yes. Sorry.
No, I is not 1 to 6. There are 6 control groups, but there are I equals 88 for the first control group. There's I equals 9. I is 1 to 9.
Really? Sorry.
Okay. And then we can do the same thing, and I won't pause on it. We can do the same thing when we want to now assess each of the individual NCC schemes. Okay, we would like to do that because it could be that NCC schemes worked well in Bardsley Close, but it's not worked well in the mobile home park, for example. So we would like to be able to say something about whether the scheme has been universally successful. And this is the model for that. You'll see that this is quite similar to what we had before, but this is now the ith member of the set of NCC zones. So there are 13 or 14 of those. I can't remember how many now, the NCC zones. And then the model follows roughly the same approach. Okay, let's get on to some results. I hope I've done a reasonable job in explaining that. Okay, down here are the results of the first model I showed you. Whether or not the program has been successful or not, as measured by whether there has been a reduction in burglary. Okay, that's all. For the output areas within which the no-call calling zone sits. Okay, and this figure here is for... each of these lines corresponds to one of the control groups. Okay, so I'm only giving you the impression out of it. These are the 6 control groups. So one of the messages we took from this is that the sets of results are kind of similar, no matter what control group you take. I mean, all of these credible intervals that are attached to the estimates of the probability of success are all roughly the same for each of these. Okay, we can dispute that they're exactly the same, of course, but they're not too wildly different. So it looks as if it doesn't make a huge difference which control group you take. If we just take all of the NCC zones as a lump, then the probability of success, and I think it's for this top one here, for all LSOAs, I might be wrong. I can't quite remember now what this figure here refers to, but it refers to the probability that the B coefficient in that impact function is less than 0, which is the zone which signifies that burglary rates have fallen. Okay.
Can you remind us, please, what these 6 lines of C's correspond to?
They correspond to...
Those 6, okay.
Yeah.
Right. From top to bottom?
Yes, well, I think so, yes, they do. All FLSOAs, burglary rates, plus or minus 10, plus or minus 20, so on. Yes, exactly the same sequence that I showed you before.
So
if we now look at the individual schemes themselves, you can see that some of them look as if they've been... Sorry, I can't reach up, but you can see that some of them lie almost entirely to the left of the B equals 0 line, which signals that they have their probability of success is quite high. Some of them, 0.99, 0.98, some of them are a good deal lower, like this one here, 0.46, where large swathes of the line lie both above and below the credible intervals associated with the estimate of B extend well to both sides of that critical threshold. Broadly speaking, success to the left, unsuccessful to the right in terms of reducing burden.
What's the distribution of that?
I seem to remember them saying they were fairly gaussian. They're not badly skewed.
I'm around that they weren't skewed.
Okay, well maybe that shouldn't be skewed, I don't know. Sorry, you can't go there. So the indication from this is that the scheme as a whole could be deemed to be successful, at least in my case as well, but that individual schemes have different degrees of success, as may measured by this criterion. Okay? Now, here's the strange bit. You may think this is all strange, but here's the really
before you move on, though.
Yes, all right.
Just looking down those for the different, whatever you call those things on the left.
Those are the OA codes.
Yes. OA codes, thanks. If you were to look down the dots on each group of lines,
yep.
The shape of the pattern of the dots is pretty similar from top to bottom.
Okay.
So, as if there is a fairly consistent pattern going across all of the OA regions.
That's the different controls.
Those are the different controls.
Yeah, so that's expressing the differences in control. Yeah, therefore, one perhaps should not read too much into the precise position of those dots, because one really wants to be looking at something which is independent of control. Or trying to.
Okay. Yes.
The percentage strings, are those numbers between brackets, are they?
They could be interpreted as the probability of success, or put slightly differently, it's the probability, it relates to the posterior density of the B coefficient in the impact function, and you can think of it as the proportion of that posterior density that lies to the left, the success zone.
But those probabilities, many of them are very high, and the lines not always are significant.
No, that's because that refers to one of them, and I can't quite remember which one it is. I think it may be this first one. There should be six numbers here, but there aren't. There just isn't room to get them all on. So we took one of them, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten which one we took, but I think it's that one. But you're quite right that there should be six numbers here corresponding to the portion of the posterior density that lies to the left in each of these things.
So for example, in that example, there is mostly unsuccess in the red.
Exactly.
And the probability is 0.46.
Sorry?
The probability of success
is 0.46.
So maybe we can think that it would be unsuccessful.
That's right. This would be classified by our sort of rule of thumb as an unsuccessful scheme. It hasn't worked there. Okay? And now I get my line out now. And now for the really strange result. Well, I don't know if that's strange, but this is... Oh, no, sorry. I'm going to jump ahead. There we are. We've done this for all the NCC zones for the whole of Cambridgeshire. Okay? We've done it for the whole of Cambridgeshire. So this now includes Peterborough, includes Cambridge, it includes Huntingdon, and one other place which is deemed to be urban, and this is for all the schemes in the non-urban part of Cambridgeshire, and without exception, none of the schemes in the rural parts of Cambridgeshire have been successful, but quite a large proportion of the urban schemes have been reasonably successful. And as somebody said, oh well, that's a small number problem, isn't it? Because you've got fewer burglaries in these places, out in the countryside. Well, maybe it is, but it shouldn't be, because the whole methodology is trying to deal with the sparsity issue. So it's not entirely convincing that it's just a statistical quirk of trying to deal with small numbers.
None is significant.
Pardon?
None is significant of the errors. Because
well,
intervals
I mean, obviously they've not all been successful. I mean, here's one, for example, this particular urban street scheme would be deemed to be unsuccessful. But the really remarkable thing is that taken as a whole, the urban schemes have been successful. Taken as a whole, the rural schemes have been unsuccessful. Individually, all the successful schemes, all the ones that have been successful by our criteria are in this group, and none of them are in that group.
There's a lot of variation in coverage, the number of participating houses in and out there. Is that similar okay. to rural and urban? Does that explain the variation on the plot you did before?
Well, I have to say this is the point at which we're trying to do more work. The grant has expired. Isn't that the way? So, point where we'll get to. I wanted to show that because I'm just conscious that maybe I'm stretching your tolerance when it comes to no-call calling zones, and people may be thinking it's time to go somewhere else. However, let me just throw in a few more issues to think about here. Data limitations, okay. Burglary counts as a measure of success. I mean, that's what we've taken. But clearly, there's a lot of grounds for debate about that. And the short length of the time series as well. Remember, we only had data from 2001 up to 2008. That's why we haven't looked at the schemes after 2007, because we just haven't got enough data after then to see. There's a huge literature on these schemes. A lot of it is quite qualitative in nature about neighborhood preventative crime schemes. And they raise all sorts of issues like, do you actually need to bring the scheme in? Isn't it enough to just say you're going to bring the scheme in? Because they've noticed that sometimes there are positive effects as soon as you announce that you're going to do something, and you don't actually have to do anything. That's putting it a little bit strongly. But there are publicity effects connected with crime prevention which maybe are totally separate from the issue of whether you actually do anything. What about displacement effects? All right, so even if you accept burglary reduction as a measure of success, what if all you've done is to displace the crime? The crime still goes on, it just goes on someone else's patch.
Well, I thought it was interesting when you were looking, comparing the urban with the rural, that the, insofar as the urban did seem to be succeeding at all, the rural seemed to be getting worse. It's as if campaigns within urban areas push them out into the rural areas.
It's possible. Yeah. Possible. I'll come back to that in a minute, because that's one of the, if you like, the next questions. There is an anecdotal evidence to suggest that there isn't always a displacement effect. There is actually a diffusion of benefit effect. But because the criminals don't know the boundaries of a zone, of a no-call calling zone, it actually puts them off a wider zone than just the actual NCC zone itself. And that there is some anecdotal evidence that there is actually a net beneficial effect.
The outer area, the further you move in outer area, which includes people, helps catch that halo effect.
In a fairly crude way, perhaps, it does, yes, yes. Heterogeneity of local impacts, threshold depletion. This is just picking up this point about coverage rate. If you plot the reduction in burglaries in the first year against the coverage rate, then that's pretty wide scattered, but if you want to put a line through it, you get something like that, which implies that the larger the coverage rate, the greater, because this is going to play, reduction, the greater the relative reduction in birth value rates in the first year. Is that a threshold effect or is it a dilution effect? By threshold we mean, in order for a scheme to be successful, does it have to have some sort of critical number of households in it? And if it's too small, then you're not going to actually achieve anything as a result of creating them. Or could it be a dilution effect, which simply means that because they're so small within an outward area, within an OA, you can't tell one way or the other. And we haven't got an answer to that.
There's one point about that graph. The slope of that line is driven, first of all, by the 2 points at zero coverage. And I think you actually have 2 points right up at the top end. One is under the red line.
Yeah.
And I think the slope of that line is driven by what is happening at
the two
opposite ends.
Okay.
And, you know, there's in the middle, the range,
it's a bit random.
From this range is from top to bottom.
Yeah. There might be. This whole issue of threshold or dilution, of threshold is quite important because some constabularies have gone for, if you want to have an NCC zone support, if you want to have NCC support, we'll give it to you. You can just have it in your house, you know, the stickers and the booklets and all the rest of it and the advice, so forth. Cambridge has gone for a different approach. It's gone for zones, in which case, if they're going for zones, is there something about the design of those zones that could be important here? We haven't got an answer for it. So I've covered that point. Oh, gosh. Concluding reflections on the No Cold Calling Initiative. Overall, implementation of NCC has been associated with reduction in burglary in those places which have been designated as NCC zones. But implementation has not apparently been associated with reduction in burglary rates in every NCC targeted neighbourhood. Now, this is where the question arises as to why that might be the case. Gillam discussed in a US context, not in this country, in a US context, wrote at some length about the effectiveness of targeted crime prevention strategies. And in his book, he suggested that to be most effective, they have to be applied in certain types of neighborhoods. And he characterized them in these terms: persistently high rates of particular crimes, the residents have not been so browbeaten by a crime that they have not lost the will to fight back, so that if they're given support by the right people, police force, training standards, whatever, then they are willing to fight back. And where there is, again, to cite this this term frequently used, there are high levels of social cohesion. People are willing to work together to tackle this particular problem. And he said that these sorts of schemes will work well where you get all these three conditions met at the same time. Now, I don't know whether that has any bearing on the results that I just reported to you or not. We would like to do some work on that, but we haven't got that yet. And he also notes that in some places, implementing a crime reduction scheme can actually lead to an increase in crime. And some work done in this country by Pease noted this in the context of improved street lighting. But actually you can take a crime prevention measure which results in more real crime. You often get more recorded crime because people feel confident and safe to report to the police, and so recorded crime can bizarrely go up. But there are even some crime reduction schemes that when you bring them in can actually make it worse, and he cited the example of improved street lighting, which can sometimes. And there are other criteria by which schemes such as the NCC might be judged. You know, are people happier? Do they feel safer in their own homes? You know, there's all sorts of criteria. But what we ultimately argue in relation to this work is that there is no one method that can carry the full weight of assessing these kinds of schemes. And this one sort of highlights the difficulties of a statistically based scheme in terms of the quality of the data, the relationship between the way the police record data and the way the government records other forms of data. And therefore, there is no one method that can carry the full burden of assessment, but we reckon that this is one that ought to form part of the total picture. As far as the statistical approach has been taken, here the benefits of fitting multi-level hierarchical models. Multi-level hierarchical models, I'll go through this very, very quickly, offer a natural framework to combine information and hence to strengthen estimation. The sparsity issue often encountered in analysing geo-referenced and or time series address can be time series data can be addressed by borrowing information, in this case from neighbouring NCC zones or neighbouring time periods, which is what was happening in those models, arriving at better, more stable, less noisy estimates of each area, and modelling spatial or temporal structures achieved by appropriate choice of random effects. Benefits of fitting Bayesian models. Since all the parameters are treated as random variables with associated posterior distributions, we can make probability statements about the parameters. That is the probability of, not has it been successful, has it not been successful, not a sort of either or, but the probability of success. Whether that would actually be more useful for the police, I don't know. They might not even like that. They might rather know yes or no rather than sort of hedge about. But in some ways that seems a more satisfactory approach from our point of view. And uncertainty, for example, in the trend functions can be more naturally accounted for in the way and then there are a variety of issues connected with fitting these models in wind farms. That's it. That's finished. I'm done.
Thank you very much. Presumably, we shall have the slides available on that website. Will you have references, bibliography for this as well?
The first paper from this project has just been accepted,
right.
And I'm very happy once the final version has been signed off to let that be available, and it has all the references. So but if you want it sooner than that,
like Ru et al. 2008 or Pease 1990.
Well, I can certainly send you those references if you would like.
Well, anyway, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And now we really can start asking questions.
This is a commentary on the situation, but I think you've touched on, you know, reasons why you could improve things. But I mean, they're quite intangible, this thing of social cohesion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I know we've got something like the Newtown Residents Association, which I think is for council flats. They seem to have some sort of get-togethers, but for sort of private areas, there may not be so much cohesion because they may not have meetings. And so, you know, perhaps the follow-up to this is what's going on now, but how could we improve it? It's not so straightforward to think how something like social cohesion could be brought in, particularly to private residents.
Well, except there's a sense in which the mere creation of these zones, part of the process that the neighbourhoods go through, is actually designed to build a certain degree of social cohesion amongst the people, because they get together as a group and they talk about the threats they perceive to their neighbourhood, and they are encouraged to share information, so that if they see people acting suspiciously, or they feel that you know, somebody's just called at their door to maybe just warn other people. So there's a sense in which this whole process is actually designed to build cohesion within neighbourhoods, and that's why this particular scheme is not unique when one talks about this particular approach to policing.
I mean, obviously, you know, it's not been as effective in some as others, so there's this still this intangible, isn't there, even though they've been meeting up, perhaps they're not as cohesive as they
you mean the rural neighbourhoods as opposed to the
yes
urban neighbourhoods. Well, as I say, we have no idea why there should have been such a stark contrast between those two sets of NCC zones. It could have something... maybe we'll never get... Perhaps at the end of the day, we'll never actually... The statistics will never answer those questions.
Because it's so aggregated up, you don't really quite know what's in there.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. Yeah. Yes.
Here in this model, you consider the number of burglaries, for example, for the control group areas, indexed by each household. So, could you consider the proportion of burglaries out of all the people living in that area?
Well, built into the model is, take that one, you have NI there. So this is the risk, if you like, of burglary in the I member of whatever control group you're talking about. And NI is the number of dwellings.
Yes.
So you could do it differently, and you could do it as a rate, but I mean, this is the normal way. This sort of model is used in disease modelling as well as in crime modelling. So you have some sort of risk of the disease, and then you have the size of the population at risk. And in this case, NI is the number of dwellings that are at risk.
Another question, particularly on this slide. I do a lot of work more about how marketing communications get propagated through neighbourhoods, essentially. And it's led me to question this very principle and point, which is, you mentioned the phrase, and you said, because it's sparse,
right,
you can use the Poisson distribution as the...
Well, it's a rare event.
Now, I've got all sorts of data that just says that's not true. And that actually, as you get to very, very sparse islands, you actually get even more interconnected between the neighbours. And I was, in a sense, hoping that was one of the things you might address, because certainly I also look at statistics on core information about fire. And in that instance, where you do, and they do actually release the address of the
defendant.
So you can see there, and it's very easy to see that if you have one person in one house get a fine, the probability of somebody else in that street having a fine just rockets.
Or indeed in that household.
I mean, especially in the household, but even more so. And it's led me to question that underlying principle. And when you see, then it makes me question whether. Right, you've got the difference between the different neighbourhoods between town, urban and rural. That makes sense. But actually, then trying to say that the policy works within a different output area for other than random reasons, I find difficult to justify. And that's why I asked the question about the distribution of that data. If it was skewed, then I might say, yeah, you've got a distribution over here of OAs for which the treatments worked. And over here a separate one in which it maybe hasn't worked. But if it's a fairly Gaussian, you're thinking, well, that's just the sampling from the same distribution that's got a shift in
right.
The process. And I'm slightly unsettled by the interpretation of a lower level than the aggregate one. Because for me, the neighbourhoods are the unit, because you rarely get independence. For me, in the data I see, you rarely get independence.
Yes,
doesn't the over dispersion deal with the...
Well, I am very sceptical of that.
Well, that was kind of what I was going to say.
Yeah, that's the traditional way of saying it. I'll just plug in an over dispersion. I'll leave all the Gaussian behavior there. But you, once you allow neighbourhoods, you actually do change. The UCL group, that temporal structure and the growth of cities, they do a lot about the way in which all of the diffusion models of growth, the way cities have one of the areas where they go up. As soon as you stop applying Gaussian models, the structure of things changes. And so you get the way roads enabled to develop. It's just not, you can't fit it to a smooth process. But anyway, I'm on a hobby horse now.
Well, I mean, far from a mere geographer to get involved in these kinds of debates, but your comment is, I think that's probably what Nicky and Sylvia would have said. I mean, this is in this model precisely to pick up intra-control regions.
Absolutely, I know that's the conventional way of solving
contagion effect. And of course, I mean, this doesn't come through in this work, but we've done some different work looking at a different aspect of crime in Peterborough, where the overall dispersion is spatial in the sense that you've got the process you've described, the contagion process that you described at the intra-geographical unit scale. As soon as the scale of that contagion process starts to seep across boundaries, you've got what geographers like to call spatial or correlation or spatial dependency effects. Yeah. And you're looking at different kinds of random effects terms to soak that up in that kind of context.
No, but I think it's... I've gone on for long enough.
you end up in this context with parallel distributions rather than with Gaussian distributions. They're very, very different in the long tails. You just cannot average them out. That's the challenge.
Can I throw the question back? What would you choose instead? How would you structure this model instead to take care of that point?
The way I look at these, and I'm sold at it, is the new parallel distributions, which end up with more sparsely distributed structures and the way things propagate. Right? What you end up doing with these is creating shapes which have a spatial dimension, and that's what a Gaussian distribution does. It basically says it has a size that's this, whereas a parallel doesn't allow a size because it scales. It's a scaling type process. They seem a better model of the way humans and diffusion occurs.
Yeah, on that point also, I mean, to some extent it's allowed for by modelling over this question in that sort of way, which is additive on not cleaner. But one can in a more basic way consider that Peter himself varies randomly. And in particular, if Peter had a gamma distribution, then determination is binomial instead of a Poisson. And one can also consider that the case where you might have either a zero inflated or zero deflated Poisson, that, you know, there may be underreporting of crimes. There was another thing that also occurred to me, a bit of a sort of side issue, but it's like an alternative mechanism, that you can have crime taking place in an area where there are no criminals. And an example of that is when I was living in Manchester, I lived in Rushall, which is sandwiched between Longside on one side and Mossside on the other, which were both homes of gangs. So Rushall was a kind of no man's land in between them, but he shoot it out. So although Rushall may have had some criminals, but it didn't have the richness of Longside on Mossside, but it's where a lot of the stuff used to happen.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, burglary perhaps is something that tends not to take place on your own patch.
There's a very rich literature, as you would expect, in criminology on this. And there was some really fascinating research done on Sheffield by one of the professors of criminology here, Tony Bottoms, with others, looking at the geography of offending in two contrasting neighbourhoods of Sheffield. So he took a reasonably affluent neighbourhood. It happened to be Dore. Those of you who know Sheffield will know Dore. Reasonably affluent. And he took a really poor part of Sheffield, which was part of the Flowers Estate. If anybody knows the Flowers Estate, it was sort of near the centre. Very poor neighbourhood. And they got the detailed crime data for both of those neighbourhoods. Now, not surprisingly, of course, if you look at the geography of crime from the point of view of the victims of crime, for the most part, there is a much greater chance, I think I'm getting this right, a much greater chance of a resident of Dore becoming a victim of some crime when they weren't in Dore. For example, their car would be stolen from the town centre, or they might be robbed in the street. Obviously, if they were burgled, they would be burgled in Dore, in their own house. But if you talk about the total victimisation experience of people in Dore, they were more at risk when they were outside Dore than when they were in Dore. Okay. Go to the Flowers Estate. Oh, and also, not surprisingly, the offender almost certainly didn't come from Dore. That's because most of the people in Dore are nice middle-class people who don't go causing crime. Pardon?
They do other
sorts of crime indeed. Exactly. and don't get caught. The Flowers Estate is completely different, as you might expect. Somebody living on the Flowers Estate is much more at risk of becoming a victim of crime in the Flowers Estate. And the offender would also come from the Flowers Estate as well. So this idea, for example, that you don't foul your own nest, in a sense, is not true in the case of offenders. It fits in very often very well with the way they function. So burglary and probably car theft are very common in the Flowers Estate, and in both cases it's done by people. And on top of that, and this is a different line of research, the people who live in the Flowers Estate are just scared to death of reporting to the police, because they'll just be victimised again for the fact that they talk to the police. So these sorts of differences are very deep-seated, very deep-seated.
Thank you very much indeed.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.